people older than 65.
Were you able to find a threshold where these small particles are all right for you?
No, and that was actually one of the key funding of this study. What was very unique about these studies was that for the first time, we used data from satellite, so then we could estimate exposure to pollution at levels that are very, very low and below the national ambient air quality standards. So they're set by the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S., and this has never been done before with the level of accuracy. Before, most of the epidemiological studies have estimated mortality risk associated with exposure of pollution only in very urban areas, which are the areas that are monitored by the EPA. So in any case, by being able to estimate exposure to pollution in more rural area and in an area where the level are very low, for the first time, we were able to estimate the risk of mortality for levels that are below the standards. Because we did the study for million of U.S. citizens, actually for 97% of the whole population in the United States, we had a higher level of accuracy in trying to understand whether or not a safe level exists. And actually, it doesn't, which really what it's telling is that we really need to reduce ambient exposure to fine particulate matter as much as possible.
Yes, there's data, and then there is stupendous mega data. I mean, you covered 12 years, millions and millions of Americans, every zip code. How can you possibly manipulate that much data and come out with something?
Well, I love this question because I am a data scientist and this is really my passion. Well, you know, of course, I assembled a fantastic team of data scientists that I could by no means do this all by myself. We linked claims data from Medicare for over 12 years with estimated exposure to pollution, as I said, using satellite data and data from the EPA for every zip code in the United States for every day for the last 12 years. Yes, this was a massive amount of data. Just to give you a sense, this was we analyzed 460 million records. How did we do it? Well, it's a mix of highly sophisticated computational approaches that we learned from the computer scientists, together with literally taking over all the entire Harvard supercomputer. We did have an ask to dedicate to these studies all of the computers at Harvard. We use Harvard, you know, we use a secure server system. And so we literally were the only one at Harvard at some point that were using the entire computing power of the university.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's saying something.
Well, also, you know, I should say that the only time we could do that was on Christmas Eve and on July 4th because, you know, everyone else was on holiday. So.
And you were hard at work. Well, let's say one fine Monday in May, we wake up and the pollution is up. Maybe the news mentions it. We see a brownish haze. We go out anyway. What did your study find out about deaths within the next 2 days or so?
Yeah, what we found is that even for this actually small increase of fine particulate matter, so let's say just one unit increase in the level of fine particulate matter from the day to the next. What we found is for one unit increase in ambient fine particulate matter from one day to the next, which is a small, tiny increase, by the way. It's not something that you will notice. A big increase is a 10 microgram per cubic meter. So for a small increase, every time you see a small increase from one day to the next of one unit in fine particulate matter, we will estimate an excess of 500 extra deaths per year every time that this happens. So in general, just think about, you know, in a ballpark number, we did say that on average, you will get, for every time there is a little bit increase in fine particulate matter, thousands, up to 20,000 senior citizens will die every year. And, you know, we're pretty confident about these fundings right now. And even, you know, in terms of the how precise these estimates are. And so it is like if someone would say to the public, look, we know that very often we might have a situation where over 20,000 senior citizens in America will die per year. I'm pretty sure that, you know, if that was a terrorist attack or was any other factor, people will intervene pretty quickly. In this situation, this is something that's happening when at the same time, unfortunately, we're seeing a tremendous amount of evidence that the current government is shutting down the Environmental Protection Agency and the science around the EPA.
Well, I want to get into that more a little bit later, but the first is something that kind of shocked me about this study, something I have to grasp with, and that is, I presume that air pollution was like smoking cigarettes, kind of a cumulative effect over years, but it seems like you're saying even one bad air day can bring an earlier death.
Yes, that's true. We published a different study back in July, actually in June, that's June in the New England Journal of Medicine. That study used a similar amount of data to provide evidence that long-term exposure, cumulative exposure to air pollution increases mortality risk. And so that is the type of chronic exposure like the one that you're mentioning in the context of, you know, chronic exposure of cigarette smoking. This particular study is different, and you're exactly right in terms of that, in a certain way, a little bit more surprising, because what we are studying are short-term effects. And so what we are studying is whether day-to-day changes in ambient exposure to pollution. So if you had an increase in exposure from pollution from yesterday to tomorrow, do we see in the same geographical location a day-to-day changes in mortality risk? And the answer is yes. And that's what it's telling us, is that ambient exposure to pollution does not only affect mortality and, by the way, many other adverse health outcomes chronically, but also as an acute effect.
And I've looked at photographs from a microscope of these tiny particles. They're not like just a bit of dust or a bit of sand necessarily. After they flow through city air, they look more like little asteroids coated with pesticides and heavy metals. Is it true that some below a certain size cannot be filtered out by the body and just go straight past our defenses into the lungs and maybe the bloodstream?
Yes, that's exactly right. Originally, years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency was regulating total suspended particles. There were much larger particle sizes. Then they transitioned into regulating PM10, which was particulate matter of a diameter of less than 10 microns. Now they're regulating PM2.5, which is particulate matter of diameter size less than 2.5 microns. Now, these are called fine particulate matters. The reason why they're called fine particulate matters is that they penetrate deep into the lung, and now there is in a lot of evidence, both from biological studies, study in vivo, study in vitro, but also from other animal studies, that by fine particulate matter, by penetrating deep into the lung, start a quite drastic inflammation system, which could affect our heart and our lungs. These are fine particulate matter in a way that you don't filter out by coughing. So, for example, if you driving in a very dusty area or there is a construction, you tend, or if your eyes are sort of burning a little bit. These are not defined particulate matter. These are called coarse particulate matter, are bigger in size, and so then you tend to filter out, which is also What is a little worrisome about the fine particulate matter, that is not something that you experience. You don't know whether or not you're breathing, or you tend not to notice whether or not you're breathing higher level of fine particulate matter.
And they can come right through the walls into the building. We could be breathing them right now. We probably are.
Exactly, exactly. Differently from ozone, ozone is a different type of pollutant, and it has a hard time to penetrate into the indoor. But actually, we have also a lot of evidence that indoor PM2.5 is higher than the outdoor PM2.5, because you have both the part of the outdoor PM2.5 that comes inside, plus some sources of fine particulate matter that comes from the inside.
Were you able to determine in this study, or have you heard from other studies, how these two pollutants affect, say, African Americans more or Hispanics more or poorer people? Is there a breakdown below the big numbers?
Yes. Many of my colleagues around the world have been providing evidence that, indeed and unfortunately, the most vulnerable, both in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of access of healthcare, in terms of having other type of comorbidity, tend to have a higher risk of mortality associated with fine particulate matter. There have been extensive studies all around the world in developing countries. The effect for fine particulate matter is devastating, especially in India and China, also because the levels in this country tend to be extremely, extremely high. In our country, in the United States in particular, both this study that we're just publishing and the study that we published in last summer, again, because we were able to rigorously study the entire U.S. population, we estimate the mortality risk associated with short and long-term exposure for people of color and for people that are in lower socioeconomic status. So we measured that because we knew from claims data the people that enroll in Medicaid, and it's very well known that people that are eligible to the Medicaid system, they have lower income. And both in the context of mortality risk associated with chronic exposure to pollution and mortality risk associated with short-term exposure of pollution, we did find that people of low income and Black particular have much, much higher risk.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest from the Harvard School of Public Health is Professor Francesca Domenici. We're talking about how even a short burst of pollution kills thousands of Americans every year. I know that you think it's important to get the word about this out there, or you wouldn't be on this program. Don't you think seniors and activists need to hear about this science? I mean, way beyond the medical journals, which incidentally are hidden behind copyright walls.
Yes, I mean, that for sure. I mean, I think that as a scientist, my main responsibility is to do high rigorous science, provide the best possible evidence, and trying to publish my science to the top medical journal where, to the degree that they can, they highly scrutinize the quality of the science that we produce through the peer review system. And then we go to press release and we talk to people like you to disseminate the evidence. But I do think it's extremely important that the American people understand the science, understand the implication of what we are publishing, because ultimately it is a responsibility of the government to making sure that we can breathe clean air. Keep in mind that differently from other type of public health risk factor, let's say smoking or stay away from fatty food, don't eat potato fries, lose weight. To a certain degree, in this context, people can have control or make choices about quit smoking and deciding to have a healthier lifestyle. In the context of breathing fine particulate matter, I mean, you know, it's not that you can stop breathing, right? So it's not that you can try to move in any every time in a different location where you think the level of pollution are lower. So it is really the responsibility of the government in trying to assure that we can breathe clean air, not only for the senior citizen, but especially for the kids and the children. By the way, not my own research, but colleagues of mine at University of Southern California have done a fantastic studies years ago that published in New England Journal of Medicine, where they've shown that kids that were in breathing air pollution have a compromised pulmonary function. And so this is kids where ultimately the pulmonary function is going to get compromised for the rest of their life. So this is serious stuff.
Now, the United States is lucky under the Clean Air Act to have the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and those are modified from time to time as new science like yours comes out. Where are we in that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Clean Air Act, which was, I would say, a fantastic victory in a certain way toward reducing ambient level of pollution. I mean, since the Clean Air Act passed in the 70s and through the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, if anyone is curious to see the ambient level of pollution in this country, they have been going down over time. And in a certain way, has been a beautiful example of setting a law, setting safety standards, looking at the evidence, reviewing the scientific evidence, and keep lowering the level. So I have to say, on a positive note, we have done, through a responsible government, through the EPA, and through the science, a fantastic job in cleaning up the air. However, I do think that we're not done yet. I do think that what we wanted to do with this study, and with the reason why we gathered an enormous amount of data, was really to see as whether the job of cleaning up the air was done or not. And even when I take this enormous study population and I only look at mortality risk associated with exposure of pollution in areas that are always below the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. So I always look at senior citizens that always live in clean area. Right? So these are people that are always in compliance. Still, we see an increase in mortality risk. So I think the bottom line is the Clean Air Act, setting National Ambient Air Quality Standards, the review of the scientific evidence by the EPA, I think has been a fantastic example of how we've been cleaning up our air, but we're not done yet.
Before we go, the Harvard Data Science Initiative, that looks very promising. What is the goal there?
Oh, yeah, I'm actually glad you asked me this. The Harvard Data Science Initiative is a university-wide initiative, has been created and funded initially by the Provost, our Provost Alan Garber. The idea is the following, not all in the context of environmental health, but in the context of all the major scientific disciplines, ranging from astronomy, ranging from medicine, personalized medicine, the public health, the economy, in social sciences. In any single discipline, we now know that we can make enormous progress in understanding and answering important scientific questions through data. Now we have available all the new type of data, data from satellite, data from cell phone, data from sensor. And so the goal of the Data Science Initiative, which we hope to become a Harvard Data Science Institute, is to bring together the best minds at Harvard that can use the best possible data to unlock important scientific questions. And this study is one example. It's an example of taking massive amounts of data, by the way, all from government sources, from satellite, from temperature, from monitoring network, from claims data, from Medicare, and to unlock important question, which in this context is, does the current level of ambient air pollution still killing us?
What will you be working on next?
Well, so many different things. One is in my role as one of the director of the Harvard Data Science Initiative. I literally try to better understand all of the different data science around Harvard so then I can empower many of my colleagues to find better treatment for cancer, to identify social injustice, to better understand the economic factors, to better understand digital economy, and so on. So I have an important role as a director of the Data Science Initiative together with my colleague and the other co-director, David Parks, who is a professor of computer science at Harvard University. Then I will continue to conduct studies in the context of environmental health, not only in terms of providing epidemiological evidence about health effects of air pollution, but more importantly in terms of understanding and providing evidence of what can we do about it, what type of regulatory intervention could allow to reduce exposure to pollution in a cost-effective manner. I am also fundamentally a data scientist and a methodologist, so I develop statistical methodology to extract useful information from messy data. And that is really important because one pattern that's happening right now with all of this data and with all of this buzz, you know, through machine learning and artificial intelligence, I think we still need to keep in mind that having a lot of data without principled way of analyzing this data, we can get a lot of confusion and not a lot of information. And finally, you know, I am a professor, so I mentor students, I mentor postdoctoral fellow, I teach classes.
Sounds like a busy life, all right. From the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with Dr. Francesca Domenici. As a professor of biostatistics, she's co-authored the paper Association of Short-Term Exposure to Air Pollution with Mortality in Older Adults. These are your doctors talking, people, so we want to listen to that. You can find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Francesca, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're very welcome, Alex. Thank you so much for covering this important science and for having me at the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In our short time remaining, here is a brief clip from early Radio EcoShock. On February 9th, 2006, my show, The Polluted Womb, reported that air pollution enters the womb and can change the DNA of babies and future health for a lifetime. Here's a clip, and I'll repost the full piece in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
A report from Radio EcoShock.
I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. Rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability.
That's right. Classrooms full of wheezing kids with inhalers in their pockets. Postmodern kids have damaged DNA and diminished IQ because chemicals are hitting them right in the womb in their earliest stages of development. Okay, this is last year's news, but the horror of industrial damage to our new generation of humans hasn't really reached us. We definitely don't want to hear that our air, seeming so clear, is poisonous. And our vehicles, those magic things that let us fly across the ground, reach right into the womb and our lungs ever after. A team of researchers led by Dr. Frederica Pereira has proven this with a groundbreaking study in New York City. The team from Columbia University followed hundreds of mothers from the first discovery of pregnancy through infancy and early childhood. One of the most important discoveries? Pesticides and other industrial chemicals are mixing with car exhaust, a kind of unseen toxic smog that penetrates the womb and harms humans at every stage of life. Pesticides cause birth defects, damage DNA, and predispose children to diseases later in life, especially cancer. We know this by science and by the sick and dying people exposed to pesticides. Of course, you don't use pesticides, just Mother Nature brand soap in your home, so you're okay, right? Not really. As Dr. Pereira describes in a 40-minute speech given to congressional staffers, pesticides are everywhere. Municipalities spray them along roads to kill weeds and trees. Condo and apartment maintenance people use them liberally. Golf course spray adds to the aerosol mist of chlorinated poisons that float across the city. And your factory farm food is laced with fungicides, insecticides, and herbicides. Blood tests of random citizens, whether in Europe or North America, reveal 60 or more toxic chemicals running around in all of us. Trust me, you're getting your fair share of the chemical feast.
I've got mercury, lead, arsenic. I've got flame retardants. I've got the stain repellent. I've got PCBs. I've got pesticides. I've got insecticides. So, you know, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me, and there are hundreds more in everybody. You burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly.
The biggest non-surprise? Automobile smog combined with pesticides and stress form a super threat to human health. The exhaust of cars and trucks, which we all take for granted, is so powerful it crosses nature's protective barrier in the womb, the placenta, and injures our babies. The number of cars and trucks has more than doubled since the 1950s. We are producing a new damaged generation, the exhausted ones. Let's introduce Dr. Frederica Pereira from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. A small story about her study broke in the New York Times for February 16, 2005. It was an Associated Press piece titled, "Pollution is Linked to Fetal Harm." Google that title, the article pops up top of the pile. It reads, "Exposure to pollutants caused chiefly by vehicles was measured by backpack air monitors worn by the women during the third trimester of pregnancy. When the babies were born, genetic alterations were measured. Researchers found an increase of about 50% in the level of persistent genetic abnormalities among infants with high levels of exposure," said the study's senior author, Dr. Frederica P. Pereira, director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. Quote, "We already knew that air pollutants significantly reduced fetal growth, but this is the first time we've seen evidence that they can change chromosomes in utero," Dr. Pereira said, adding that the kind of genetic changes that occurred had been linked in other studies to increased risk of cancer. Well, those three paragraphs in the New York Times note that vehicle exhaust is altering the genes of newborns and a whole generation, and not in a good way. It's a shame that car pollution stories don't warrant the full-page spreads available to car makers and oil company advertisers. But Dr. Pereira said much more in a talk titled "Prenatal Exposures to Pollutants and Future Health Risks." It was part of a policymaker education course for congressional staff, organized by the Harvard Medical School Center for Health and the Global Environment. It was on March 30, 2005. You can be briefed like the Congress staff by watching the video. I'll tell you how to find the video and a better quality audio version of the speech later in this broadcast. You can find my 2006 piece, The Polluted Womb, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. From our first moments of life to our last, air pollution can damage human health. Let's clear the air. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.